This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by GoEngineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the UAVDigest.com/GoEngineer. You're listening to episode 227 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Fort Washington, Pennsylvania. Hey, Max, how are we?
Good. You know, David, you had a few stories for this episode. I had a few stories. Our listeners had some stories. And it just seemed like drone news was popping up all over. We might have kind of a lot for the episode this week, but it's all great stuff.
It really is. And every so often we get one story that catches our listeners' imaginations. And we're not going to discourage it, but we get lots and lots of emails about the same story. And we have one of those tonight. So that's always kind of fun. But tonight we've got New Jersey jail time, disaster response in Florida, thousands and thousands of swarms of drones, chutes and Harriers, peeping drones, and of course, this week in FAA news. We need some sort of musical tag for that, I think.
We'd be playing it every week, I think.
Well, our first story comes from AIN Online. New Jersey passes UAV penalty bill. Well, the New Jersey Assembly passed a law, bill number 5205, that creates fines and prison terms for unsafe or prohibited operations of UAVs. Well, what does that mean, Max?
Well, there are jail terms of up to 6 months and fines up to $1,000 for operating a drone in a manner that could endanger life or property, or while under the influence of alcohol or drugs, or for the purpose of taking or assisting in the taking of wildlife. So that's 6 months, up to 6 months, up to $1,000. But there's another category of infractions that get you more jail time and a bigger fine, potentially.
18 months jail time and up to $15,000. Operating a drone near a correctional facility. How many stories have we had, Max, where we hear people trying to fly drugs in, or cell phones, or keys into correctional facilities.
Right.
A manner that interferes with first responders or lawful hunters. Interesting. They don't want you to use them to hunt, but they don't also want you to use them to interfere with hunters, as in protesters who don't like hunting. So, and last, in a manner to circumvent a restraining order. Can you say peeping Tom?
There are some other things in this bill as well that are kind of note. One is that critical infrastructure or political subdivisions, and I'm not sure what a political subdivision is, can prohibit drones from operating in close proximity. So, I mean, that makes sense. If you got a facility...
I was going to say a political subdivision in New Jersey would be a township, I believe.
So then that would mean that, what, a township could declare that drones are prohibited, a no-drone zone, essentially, and then the fines under this bill would apply. That's interesting. It also notes that state law preempts any municipal or county measures that conflicts with the state prohibitions and penalties. So in other words, if something more local than the state level, a municipality or a county enacts some other specific measures that conflict, then the state law takes precedence. So yeah, New Jersey is getting serious about fines and jail terms for certain kinds of activities.
I can't disagree with everything that they've come up with, other than they don't have the authority to enforce it because their aircraft, and I don't know. This is going to be one of those things that I'm sure is going to get challenged. But I mean, and my other problem with this is it's like we've talked about in the past, Max. I can't stand laws that regulate common sense.
Yeah. On your first point, I think you're right that the notion of who has jurisdiction over aircraft, if you want to call unmanned vehicles aircraft, who has jurisdiction is still to be decided in the courts. But, you know, I mean, this is well intended, I think. The New Jersey legislators are trying to respond, I believe, to what they see as concerns by the public. And so this is what we get. We get laws passed.
And like I said, flying near a correctional facility and some of the other stuff, critical infrastructure. There are nuclear power plants in New Jersey. That kind of thing, it makes sense. But it's just sort of, we're still regulating common sense. But let's talk about more positive regulations. Florida International University, UAS Management for Disaster Response, has a workshop. And this was from SUAS News. FIU, or Florida International University, is hosting a 40-hour advanced-level workshop tailored for UAS operators, airspace managers, and emergency management officials.
No, that's right. This is about teaching disaster response for UAS operations. And one of the things that becomes apparent pretty quickly when you look into this training is that it's highly interactive. It doesn't sound at all like you sit in a classroom and get lectured to. There's a lot of work out in the field. There are some instructors that have a lot of experience in emergency management, disaster response, and there's a lot of interaction with those instructors. The attendees are divided up into small teams. And among other things, they actually get together and solve Hurricane Irma scenario-based problems. So I think this is good. There's a lot of issues when you're talking about using drones in natural disasters or man-made disasters, scenarios like that, that goes beyond just how do you fly the drone. There's a lot of coordination with other officials, and there's a lot to it. So this seems like a pretty comprehensive approach.
Yes, it's being run by Airborne Response. However, if you want to keep your relationship, I don't know whether you're going to be able to get away with going because it's February 12th through 16th, but it is in Miami, so you might want to bring your spouse along for Valentine's Day. But more to the point, this kind of networking and training is very important, especially if we push forward that drones are really helpful and first responding. And we learned that over the last year with the hurricane responses. So good for Florida International University. And hopefully if someone goes, maybe they can send us a response and let us know how they went. Or if somebody knows from Florida University wants to invite Max and I down for the weekend, I'll be happy to go.
Yeah.
With this winter, Miami in February sounds pretty good.
It sure does. Now, we'll have a number of links in the show notes to some information about this. There's quite a lot of it out there. And even if you are not able to attend this session, but if you're in this kind of business, in other words, the disaster response, you might want to take a look at what they're doing. And I think it's a good sort of benchmark, I think, to compare other programs against.
So let's move from Florida across the globe to China. This was from Popular Science or PopSci.com. China is making 1,000 UAV drone swarm now. That's a lot of drones flying in formation.
God, it's incredible. Ehang UAV set a world record in December for the largest drone swarm ever deployed, It was 1,180 drones that together created a 9-minute aerial light show. So think about what we've seen from Intel recently in the last few months. And this is quite a bit larger, but and inexpensive too. Each drone, each of these drones costs $1,500. So multiply that by 1,180, and it's that's a lot of hardware, David.
It's $1,770,000.
And you do that in your head?
No, I do that on my iPhone calculator.
Okay.
I'm old enough to remember doing things on pad and paper, and you were never going to use a calculator. So my Texas Instruments Scientific. But I now have a phone that has more power than an Apollo lunar module. So therefore, I'm going to use it. But I digress. Things it can do is it makes a tree, a ship, and of course, they're like the Intel ones that should they lose power or something, they autonomously land if they have an issue. So this is the future of fireworks, I think, Max. Drones are environmentally safe fireworks, you know, and reusable.
Yes, I think 1,000 LED lights up in the sky are pretty capable of producing a pretty magnificent display. When we first start talking about drone swarms and aerial shows at night, I was kind of pessimistic that they could ever really replace fireworks. But when you're talking about the number of drones that they're able to coordinate now, that's just it's just fantastic. The one thing, though, that I guess they haven't figured out how to do is create those booms that you get from fireworks, especially the ones that happen after the, you know, the visual display sparkles in the sky, and you think you're waiting for the next rocket to go up, and then that boom hits you that you weren't expecting. I guess we need to figure out a way to do that with these drone swarms.
That's called the 1812 Overture in the United States Army Fire Squad, where they use the cannons in D.C.
Yes.
Or in Boston. That's one of my, that's always been one of my dreams, to be in Boston Commons to listen to the Boston Pops do the 1812 Overture on 4th of July.
Hmm.
You know, the da 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 dum bum, bam! You know, that nothing beats a 21 cannon salute.
For sure.
But okay, shoot. A cannon shoot. So I guess that means the next thing we should talk about are parachutes?
This is from a company that's called Fruity Shoots. New Harrier parachute launcher is light, compact, and easy to use. Now, Fruity Shoots produces parachute recovery systems for a number of larger drones, but what they've done here is announced a new drone parachute launcher. They call it the Harrier Drone Parachute Launcher, and it's designed for small fixed wing and multicopters, your Phantoms and Mavic Pros and things like that. And what this has is a canister. It's a thin wall carbon fiber canister. It's got lightweight nylon parachute inside and a high energy compression spring. I think this makes a lot of sense, especially if you've got some pretty expensive hardware you're trying to fly around. But they've got a couple of different models of this this Harrier parachute system.
And of course, we have two pilots on that other show that are quite fond of ballistic recovery systems.
Yes, we do.
We'll have a list of the show notes about what's available with their ratings, their total weights, and their sizes. And their prices run from $310 to about $352. They have worked with UAS customers, Textron, Quest, Falcon, Zipline, Matternet, and they're also in with SpaceX, Google, Intel, NASA, MIT, and Boeing. So these guys are really good at what they do. And of course, we have UAV Propulsion Tech, our sponsor, who also sells ballistic parachute recovery systems. And we'll have a list of other available people who you can hunt down and get your parachute for your drone. Now, reading this article today, Max, I used to think about my model rocketry.
Mm.
And there was nothing worse than a really effective parachute. because usually the wind would catch it and your rocket would go forever.
That's right.
We always cut large holes in the center of our parachutes. So they would come down, but come down quickly so we could recover the rocket. So I'm wondering how these work with the UAVs. And Lord knows you don't want your to implement your ballistic parachute and then have your drone go blowing away into a tree somewhere. So,
or so far away that you can't find it. Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point. If you're considering incorporating a recovery parachute on your drone, you want to make sure that the capacity of the parachute matches the size of the or the weight of the drone you've got, right? So like you say, David, a too big parachute on a too small drone is not going to be good, but the inverse is also bad in that you've got the thing dropping at a slower speed than if it had no parachute, but you don't want it to drop so fast that you end up damaging your equipment. Another issue I think might be deployment trigger. How is that triggered? Is it a manual trigger that you execute from your controller or your smartphone or whatever you're using? Or is it triggered by the drone itself that detects conditions that would warrant the deployment of the parachute? So those are kinds of things to think about. And yeah, as you mentioned, there are a lot of companies in this space producing a lot of different products that try to satisfy this market. But I think it's big, especially for drones that have a lot of video gear on them, drones that have a lot of expensive sensors on them that may not survive a fall out of the sky. This is definitely something to take a look at.
Okay, let's talk about peeping drones. This is from thedrive.com. Israeli researchers use radio signals to detect peeping drones. This is a way to prevent people from using a new tool to stalk other people. How it works is it creates a pattern of the object you want to monitor, like your house.
The system here is monitoring the radio signals coming from that drone that you spot hovering over your backyard or near something that you don't want to be observed. And then it employs, they say, some type of pattern matching that tells you if the drone is looking at you by analysis of these radio signals. And this comes from researchers at Ben-Gurion University. But they also have a video, and we'll have video in the show notes, Game of Drones Detecting Streamed POI from Encrypted FPV Signal. And the video kind of describes a different scenario. Here the drone is looking at the neighbor's house, and the neighbor sees this drone or hears this drone and has one of these systems. And what happens is that the drone is communicating with its controller through an encrypted channel, and the person in the house actually flicks the shades, which causes the signal, the bit rate actually of the signal, the encrypted signal, to change. And in observing that bit rate changed in sync with flicking the shades, the idea is that tells you that, yep, that drone is looking at your window. So a couple of different approaches, but it's really quite amazing what they're able to do. Because, I mean, my first thought upon reading this was, yeah, well, what if the signal's encrypted? How are you going to do the pattern matching? And so they show an example of how that might be done. But if you really want to get into it deep, there's a research paper, and you can take a look at that. We'll have a link to that in the show notes.
Well, 2 years ago, Max, we were talking about registering drones.
Hmm.
Beginning of December, they said they were going to come up with a registry by Christmas. And we went, right. And then it happened. They created one and people started registering drones. And in 2016, or I guess it was 2016 that we had drone registry. And in 2017, someone said, no, that's against the law. And later in 2017, they said, no, it's now the law again. And in the meantime, our recent Secretary of Transportation, Ellen Chao, announced at CES that we've topped over 1 million registered drones. Would you believe it?
It's a big number. And of course, it's made up of commercial registrations and hobbyist registrations. And the breakout there is that approximately 1 million figure includes 878,000 hobbyists who've registered their drones and received their identification number, which of course applies to all of the drones that each individual owns. And in addition, 122,000 commercial registrations and commercial and public sector and other drones. And of course, those drones are individually registered. So you add those two up and you get pretty close to 1 million. And that's an awful lot of registrations.
But with every FAA good news, there's FAA bad news. And this came from our friend Jonathan Ruprecht at jrruprechtlaw.com. There's a class action lawsuit, Robert Taylor versus the FAA, on second drone registration class action lawsuit. So we're in round two after we've made a law saying that you have to re-register your drones. We're now back to another lawsuit. This one's a little bit larger.
Quite a bit larger. And if Taylor sounds familiar, that's the name of the guy who filed the earlier lawsuit that resulted in the courts indicating that the FAA didn't have the authority to require registration. That was John Taylor. This lawsuit is from Robert Taylor, who is John's brother. And in this lawsuit, it's a class action lawsuit. They allege four different counts. And there's a detail about this at jrruprechtlaw.com. But to try to make it a little bit more concise, the first count is that the FAA collected personal information and money under the drone registration program. But when it was declared illegal, the FAA continued to collect and retain all of the personal information and money. They didn't delete the registry or refund the money. And then another count is this Little Tucker Act. And under that act, the federal government's sovereign immunity is waived when the government takes money from individuals in violation of a statute. And the third count is that the FAA violated the plaintiff and the class's constitutional and privacy rights by unlawfully promulgating the regulation rule and enforcing the registration rule without any statutory authority to do so. Also, that once the court vacated the registration rule, the FAA did not delete the private and personal information of model aircraft owners and didn't refund the money. And then the fourth is an unjust enrichment claim due to collecting over $4 million in fees. Now, this class action lawsuit, it looks to get the $5 back, but it also calls for statutory damages. And you put all those things together and multiply them by the over 800,000 people that registered. And the number, it's staggering.
$836,796,000. And they want $1,000 per person.
Right, which is the statutory damages. So, wow. No idea where this is going to go. I think we're a long ways away from the resolution of this, but you know we're going to have to follow this with some interest. I think it's unlikely that the federal government is going to have to fork over almost $1 billion, but we'll see.
Well, if the government shuts down the day we release this, it really won't matter, will it?
I think that's what Drone Mama said. If the government shuts down, they can't pay anything anyway, so what's the deal? Oh, boy.
Let's talk a little bit real quickly. This is from our news page on UAVDigest.com. Scott & Scott Attorneys of Law, LLP, alerts investors to security class actions against GoPro. Unfortunately, we reported that GoPro was getting out of the UAS business. So check our homepage and you'll see the lawsuit that's involving the Karma drones. Not surprising, there's a class action suit because there's a lot of people who bought them. And Max, we've got a couple of media partnerships to talk about, and they involve cargo carrying drones, both of them.
That's right. There are two conferences coming up this year that cover unmanned air cargo. The first is the Unmanned Cargo Aircraft Conference, which is coming up real fast. That's March 20th at the North Carolina Global Trans Park in Kingston, North Carolina. And that conference looks to bring together manufacturers, operators, knowledge institutes, consultants, shippers, and government organizations who are active in the field of unmanned cargo aircraft, and they're going to, or UCA, and they're going to talk about UCA business models. How do you earn money with UCA configurations? What should they look like? What's the regulatory landscape? Societal benefits? What can UCA contribute to economic and social development, as well as industrial participation and market analysis? So you'll be able to find a link. Actually, you'll be able to see a banner for the conference on our website. The link to the conference itself, this one is unmannedcargoaircraftconference.com. Now, there's a second conference in June. This is the Cargo Innovation Conference. It's in the Netherlands, June 6th and 7th, 2018. And the idea here is that this conference will address the impact of digitalization of logistics processes on efficiency, profitability, user friendliness, transparency, things like that. And this conference is going to look at multimodal, unmanned, and autonomous cargo systems, 3D printing, blockchain and security, virtual and augmented reality, as well as robotics and some other issues as well. And that that website is cargoinnovationconference.com. But again, you don't need to remember those if you don't need to. And just visit the UAVdigest.com and look for the banners for those conferences on the right-hand side.
So every so often, like I said at the beginning of the show, we get one of those stories that just sort of everybody's fascinated with, and they send it to us. And Max and I love it. It is kind of funny. We got several of this story, and this is from our listeners down in Australia. And it's actually the BBC.com. Drone saves two Australian swimmers in world's first. And this is our video of the week.
This is kind of a neat story. This is about two teenage boys, and they were out in some pretty heavy surf, pretty far from the shoreline, about 2,300 feet from the shoreline. Now, the folks doing the life-saving down there in Australia have been looking at this this drone that drops an inflatable device that's meant to assist swimmers in distress. And sort of in the midst of all that, they got a call that these two teenage boys were out there in the water and they were having a real tough time of things. They deployed this drone. It's actually a little Ripper UAV. And they sent it straight out to these two kids out in the water.
And they dropped the inflatable rescue pod and the pair made their way safely to shore. The drone took 60 seconds to reach the boys. It's estimated lifeguards would have taken 6 minutes.
What a difference, huh?
I think this is the future of life-saving, at least for ocean-going life-saving. I don't see this happening over your local public pool, but to be able to deploy something that quickly is really impressive. And there's something to be said for having an eye over the shore. You know, having a drone watching everybody will be able to see things that you might not see from a lifeguard stand. So I think this is a very first and definitely one of those drones for good stories that we've always talked about since from day one. So I recommend highly that you go look at this video off of our website because it is pretty phenomenal.
Yeah, and the video that you get to see is the footage taken by the actual drone. So you're looking down at the water. You're looking down at the two teenage boys. You see the drone eject this inflatable rescue pod. It, you know, it falls down to the water, inflates. The kids grab on. This is real stuff. So I can see why so many folks were excited about this and sent it along to us. We want to thank John Henry and Steve and all the others
Ray,
all our friends down under who pointed out this story in this video to us. So thanks, guys.
And just to reiterate, we're not complaining that we got this story a lot because it was a great story. So if when you see something, send it to us because if we get a lot, we just laugh about it, but we know it's important and you guys want us to talk about it. So really good with that. I think, Max, we should wrap this up. What do you think?
Yeah, we want to thank all of you for listening to episode 227 of the UAV Digest. As always, you can find us at the UAVDigest.com. And show notes are there for every episode. If you want to go straight to those for this episode, it's the UAVDigest.com/227. And of course, we're all over social media.
You can find us on Twitter at the UAV Digest, on Facebook, facebook.com/UAVDigest. We want you to become part of our Slack listener team. You can do that by sending us an invite. And you can become one of our power users and catch up on all of the stories that we don't get to talk about. And you can do that by sending us an email, which is feedback@theuavdigest.com. If you really want to help us, leave some feedback at iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play. Or you can purchase some swag at our Cafe Press store. So I guess with that, I'm going to say this is David in Fort Washington, Pennsylvania.
And Max in Hartford.
Thank you for listening.